Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Back in the spring, the Gallup organization conducted a survey. They asked Americans a number of things, and as they often do, they asked them about their biggest financial worry. And people said their biggest financial worry is retirement income. And it's perhaps not surprising that people would be concerned because regularly in the news, we hear concerns about Social Security. That, of course, is not new. For some time now, people have been questioning whether or not when it comes time to pay out those benefits, the money will be there. A little bit more recently, we have started to hear concerns about pensions, about whether or not, particularly when it comes to defined benefit plans, when it comes time to pay out that money, whether employers actually will have it. Also, recently, we've been hearing employers saying that they were going to reduce their contributions to their workers' plans. Some have said they're just going to stop altogether. We're going to try to review some of this material here this morning in this first part of Focus 580 as we talk with Jeffrey Brown. He is Assistant Professor of Finance here at the University of Illinois. Before that, he spent a year as a senior economist with the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He also served as economist on the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, and before that, taught at Harvard. Since last November, he's also been serving on a national expert panel formed by the National Academy of Social Insurance to look at whether and how individual accounts can be implemented as part of Social Security. So we'll try and talk about a number of things here this morning, and of course, as always, questions are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of people who call in is that they try to be brief. We ask that so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to be here.
When we talk about potential sources of retirement income for people to draw on, the ideal is that people will have a mix of sources, that people will be able to get something from Social Security, that their employer will provide some kind of a pension, and during the time that they're working, the ideal also is that they're supposed to have been saving somehow on their own. And the idea was that there would be a mix of sources, that no one of these things, nobody was ever going to have to rely on one of these things. Now, that's the ideal, that there was supposed to be this mix of sources to draw on. But when you look at the way things really are, what does it look like?
Sure. You're exactly right that sort of the idealized pension system, the analogy that is often used is of a three-legged stool. And the idea is if you think of retirement security as the thing that we're trying to support, the idea was that a three-legged stool can really only stand and support itself as if it has all three of those legs and they're equally strong and stable. And in the area of retirement income security, those three areas, as you mentioned, are Social Security, pension, and private savings. The issue that we face is, as you know and as you mentioned, the Social Security system we've known for some time is in need of reform because it's facing sort of very severe long-term financial crises. The thing is that Social Security today actually accounts for much more than one-third of the income of the average individual. In fact, it varies a lot across the income distribution. But if you look at, say, the bottom one-fifth of retirees in terms of income in the United States today, they rely almost exclusively on Social Security. We also know that the private pension system, which we'll discuss in more detail, at any given point in time only covers somewhere between 50% and, say, two-thirds of employees in this country. And so there's a large segment of the population that does not have a private pension. And then finally, the United States is not exactly known as being a nation of savers. Our personal savings rates in the United States are actually low, both by international and by historical standards. And so it's really important looking forward as we think about retirement policy to examine all three of these pieces.
Just, I'm curious because certainly there are some people who don't participate in the Social Security system. For example, the people who work for the University of Illinois.
Because that's correct.
We participate in state-run pension systems. We don't pay into Social Security. And there's something we'll perhaps talk about later because there are some people who think that people like that should be paying into Social Security, but this is that's a separate question. Just I'm curious about when you look at American workers, how many people or, say, what percentage of American workers don't participate, don't pay into Social Security?
Sure. It's actually rather small. Over 90% of the population in the U.S. is covered by the Social Security system, so fewer than 10% are not. And I should also mention that even employees of state university systems where some states like Illinois have opted out of the system, if they earn income in addition to their primary job, if they do consulting on the side or what have you, they will pay something into that system as well.
Hmm. Right. Well, let's talk about Social Security. And the big concern that people seem to have, and we've been hearing that for some time now as public policy people talk, as politicians talk, and if you go out on the street and you ask people, the big concern seems to be that in the future, there's not going to be enough money to pay the benefits and the benefits that people will be coming forward to claim. And it seems in large part to do with demographics.
That's correct.
That we're going to, in the future, we're going to have more retirees than we're going to have current workers paying into the system to be able to support them. And people are very worried that particularly it seems to be younger people are worried that when it gets to that point, when they march through the years, when it gets to that point and they retire, there won't be any money there to pay the benefits. So how real a concern is that?
Well, it is a real concern about the ability to pay out the benefit levels that are currently enshrined in our current Social Security laws. Though I do think some of the concern is exaggerated insofar as there was a poll done about a decade ago among Generation Xers, so people in their 20s and their early 30s. And the poll found it was sort of a famous survey because the punchline was that a larger fraction of that population believed in the existence of UFOs than believed that Social Security would be there for them. I think realistically the issue is not whether Social Security is going to be there, but how generous it can afford to be. And you're right that it's all a result of demographics, and the number that I think the numbers that I think portray this most significantly are as follows. It's first important to understand that the Social Security system is not really a system of savings. So when a worker pays into the Social Security system, unlike a private pension plan where those dollars are sort of invested in real assets, stocks and bonds, what happens in Social Security is that when that money is paid in, it is immediately turned around and paid out to today's retirees. It's what an economist often refer to as a pay-as-you-go plan. What this means is it's actually very sensitive to demographic changes. When we go back to the 1950s, for every retiree who is receiving benefits from the Social Security system, there were 16 workers who were paying taxes to support that one retiree. By the time John Kennedy was elected president in the early 1960s, there were only 5 workers paying into the system for each retiree. Today, that ratio is down to just over 3, and in the next generation, it's going to fall further to only about 2 workers per retiree. So a way to think about that is quite simple. If you want to pay, say, $16 to a retiree, well, 50 years ago, we only had to collect $1 from each worker. In a generation, we're going to have to collect $8 from each worker in order to pay that same level of benefits. And so it's that demographic change which is really driving the fiscal problems facing Social Security.
When people talk about this, often they talk in terms of the number of years until the time that we're really in trouble.
That's correct.
Some people would say, well, okay, we're okay this year, we're okay next year, we'll probably be okay 5 years from now. But then maybe different people have different numbers. Is there a date or a year that is generally agreed upon that people would say, if we don't do anything by this time, then we're going to have a problem?
Right. There are two dates of significance, and people debate about which is the more important one. The first date, and the one that I personally believe is the more important one, is currently 2018, so 15 years from now. That is the year in which the taxes that are being collected to support the Social Security system are no longer going to be enough to cover the benefit payments. So that's the point in time in which the federal government is going to see Social Security go from a program that's running surpluses to a program that's running big deficits. And those deficits are going to grow at an amazingly rapid speed. By the, say, 30 to 35 years from now, those deficits alone in today's inflation-adjusted dollars are on the order of $300 billion. Now, that's a big number. What does that mean? That's something like $2,000 per household in the United States. It's a very significant amount of money, and it's more than we spend on any government program other than Social Security and defense. The other number that is sometimes used is the date in which the Social Security Trust Fund will be exhausted. We could have a long discussion about the trust fund and what it means and what it does not. That date is about 40 years from now, around 2042. And all that means is that's the point in which technically the system actually officially becomes bankrupt, and the Social Security system will no longer be permitted to write checks until something is done to fix the system.
Well, that gets in an issue that, and I know I have talked about it with various guests, and other people have said, well, that people don't really quite understand Social Security, or that the way we talk about it isn't quite the way that it is. We talk about it as if there was a bank account somewhere with Social Security on it, and that the contributions people make to Social Security go into that bank account, and then from that bank account, checks are written for the people who are getting the benefits. And they say, well, that's really not the way it is, that the contributions go into the general revenue of the federal government, and then the payments come out of there. And what Social Security is it's a promise to pay. It's a commitment to pay.
That's correct.
And that if you look at it that way, then you have to say, well, the Social Security would only go bankrupt if the government of the United States goes bankrupt, and that what was going to have to happen, that we could not change anything else. We would just have to say, well, when we get to that point, we're simply going to have to find the money someplace, which means that we're going to be spending less on something else and putting that money into Social Security. So in talking about it going bankrupt is kind of the wrong sort of image. I mean, is that really true?
It is certainly the way I prefer to look at the Social Security system is that in 15 years, we're going to start to run these cash deficits. So we're going to no longer have enough tax revenue by the government to pay for the benefits. And the question becomes, what happens from then on? If you want to think about what the real trust fund or the real lockbox is in the United States economy, it is the United States economy. It's not some government account where the money is sitting in a vault and buried beneath a mountain somewhere. Instead, it's the ability of the U.S. economy to produce the income that can then be taxed to provide these benefit payments. I think it's very dangerous, however, to assume that the problem we can just wait and deal with it later. We actually have far more options available to us if we start early because of the fact that for the next 15 years, we're actually bringing in more money than we need to. What's happening with that money now is it's just being spent on other things. If we could find a way to set aside those resources in a way that actually truly contributes to national savings and grow the economy, we make it easier on ourselves in the future. But I think it's useful to think about what the magnitude is of the change that's required. Today, for every $100 that a person earns that is covered by the Social Security system, we take about $10, just under $11 of their income to pay for benefits. Okay, we actually tax them at a rate a little more than that, and some of that is the surplus. But we take approximately $11 out of every $100 that is earned today to pay benefits to retirees and other recipients. 75 years from now, according to current projections, we'd need almost $20 out of that $100. I mean, that's a very significant increase in tax rates. And this is on top of even bigger deficits that we face for Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. So as a fraction of our sort of nation's output, these programs are currently on a path that we just cannot possibly sustain. And I think that's why most people believe that, you know, Social Security is not a question of if we do it. We have to reform the system, and the bigger debate is over how we're going to do it.
Well, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Jeffrey Brown is assistant professor of finance at University of Illinois. He teaches on and does research on Social Security, pensions, retirement planning, insurance. We're talking here a little bit about the future of Social Security. Also, we'll go on and say some things about pensions, and questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, let's, before we go on to the pension issue, let's stay with Social Security here for a moment and talk about what maybe could be done or should be done. Obviously,
sure.
What has been done in the past to deal with the demands of retirees. We have continued to take more money from workers. So what we could do is, that might be difficult, maybe politically impossible, but we could say, okay, we could increase the amount that we're taking out of people's checks. We could, say, extend the continue to push forward the age at which people can receive benefits, which we have done. We can reduce the benefits that people get. All of those things possible, and all of those things perhaps difficult. Do we have other choice? Do you think that we have other choices when it comes to this question, okay, what do we do?
Right. Well, this is actually the reason that back in the 1980s, the former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, once famously quipped that Social Security was the third rail of American politics. You touch it and you die. This was obviously an analogy to the third rail on subway lines that are the electricity that runs them, and you can be electrocuted if you try to touch them. It's a difficult issue. If we set aside for a moment the debate about personal accounts and individual accounts, and we focus on what changes can be made just within the existing system, then none of the choices are pretty, but they're obvious. It's kind of like if you want to lose weight, you either need to eat less or exercise more. Within the existing structure of the system, the only real choices we have are to slow the growth of benefits or cut benefits, to raise taxes, or to take money away from other programs. Or, of course, we could, in the short run, borrow money, but that just means higher taxes in the future. So there really aren't very many pretty options there. The big debate and the great debate that I'm sure will be part of the 2004 presidential campaign again is what role, if any, should individual accounts play as part of a reform effort? I am in the camp that believes that any reform, almost by necessity, has to include some element of individual accounts. But I am also a believer that other changes are still going to be necessary. Individual accounts, despite what we'd all like to be the case, are not by themselves the panacea that will solve the entire fiscal problem. But they offer a number of benefits to individuals and to the system as a whole, depending on how they're structured. For one thing, we mentioned that in the short run, the Social Security system is actually running surpluses today. Where are those dollars going? Well, they're flowing into Treasury, and then those dollars are essentially used to support deficits in other parts of our government. So we spend it to pave roads or invest in Homeland Security or what have you. If those dollars were instead flowing into individual accounts and were therefore off the government books, it's far more likely that that's going to contribute to actual national savings, which will help to increase investment and grow the economy. So that's one, I believe, powerful economic reason why we might want them. And frankly, it's also the case that workers, especially younger workers, really most of them seem to want these and value them because they can be bequeathed when people die early. They give individuals choice and ownership. And as a result of that, and as a result of the fact that people can pursue higher rates of return depending on their investment choices and so forth, it gives us the opportunity to make some of the changes to the traditional system that we need in order to put it onto a sustainable path.
When we look at some of the debate about individual accounts that's happened now, I suppose that there are some people who would make the argument, to take one case over all the way on one side, we make the argument that what we should do is just phase Social Security out, in a sense, and move to the point where there just isn't any more government system and everybody is just expected to have their own plan. their own private plan. And then sort of on the other side would be some sort of a mixed thing that would sort of said, okay, some of your money, just like always, is going to go into Social Security, but we're going to say some percentage we're going to set aside, and we're going to say to you, now you can decide within some specified range of choices, because there also seems to be concerns about, well, we want to make sure that people invest that. If they're going to make a decision on investing, we want to set up a system so that it's almost impossible for them to lose. We don't want them to be able to lose that money. So we're going to say, okay, a couple of percent of the money that's taken out of your check, you may decide how it's invested, and here are the choices that you have. So maybe we're going to say, okay, you can take 3% and you can put it into these mutual funds if, you know, and you can choose. I guess then, to me, the question seems to be, well, is that really going to make very much difference either to that individual or to the system as a whole?
Right. And let me begin. I think you've raised a very important issue. There are still some people out there that believe that the right thing to do is just to completely dismantle the current system. I don't think that's what most people who are supporters of individual accounts have in mind. That's certainly not where I would go. I believe there's a very important role for sort of a safety net that the traditional system provides, a basic level of retirement income that everyone can have, so that if people do run into difficult times in their life, there's something that they can count on. What I am more in favor of are these mixed systems where we take a portion of the payroll taxes and we allow people to invest that. As you very accurately pointed out, most of the realistic proposals that are on the table today would put some investment restrictions in place. So we'd allow people to choose, for example, do I want to have some exposure to the stock market or not? They wouldn't have to. They could invest in government bonds if that's what they wanted to do. But we would not allow them to go and put, you know, 100% of their money in the next hot tech IPO. We understand, and everyone understands, that you need to have some restrictions on that. The model that is often used is the model of the federal thrift savings plan, which a lot of federal employees are part of, which basically has five investment options, and they're all broadly diversified. So there's a U.S. stock market option, an international option, a corporate bond fund, and so forth. And I think that's the type of thing that people have in mind. Your question, though, is how much would it help? Mm. Well, the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, which I had the honor of working with, looked at a number of plans. And the plans that they put forward all combined this introduction of personal accounts with other changes to the underlying system. And you need to look at the whole package to understand how we sort of get from here to there. One of the plans that they had in place would simply slow the growth rate of traditional benefits so that they would grow with inflation rather than faster than inflation, as is currently in their current law, so that retirees in the future would get essentially the same benefit that today's retiree get from the traditional system, and in addition would have a personal account that they can contribute a couple of percent of their wages to each year. And that system, it takes a while to get there, but it puts the system back on a permanently sustainable course where after a few decades, the income and the revenue and the benefit payments from the system would again be equalized. So it can actually have quite a big effect.
Well, we have a couple of callers to talk with. Anybody who's listening, of course, are welcome to call in. And let me tell you again, our guest is Jeffrey Brown. He is Associate Assistant Professor of Finance at University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about, have been talking here about Social Security. We do want to go on and see a few things about pensions. But, of course, questions, whatever questions you have are welcome. We'll start out with someone in Urbana, and that's line one.
Yes, good morning. Well, I'll just say generally about the word reform. There was reform in the power companies, and I ended up paying more money. There was reform when cable television was unregulated, and I ended up paying more money. So the word reform is sometimes kind of thrown around as a way of hoodwinking people that there's some really good, substantial reforms going on, real substantial changes. The pension plan at the University of Illinois was in the same problem that Social Security is in now. People kept paying in to the university retirement system, and instead of collecting that money and investing it, it went into the general state accounting. And then the state simply paid out whatever people's University of Illinois, State of Illinois pensions were. And there was a big move here, maybe 20 years ago, to really allow the money to be collected and invested by a controlled group. And therefore, we have CSRS at the University of Illinois, which does collect the pensions, does not just turn it over to the Treasury for the State of Illinois. And they have done an excellent job and are staying ahead of the requests. So I think that perhaps the Social Security changes should follow that format. The Social Security surplus should be allowed to build up. It should be handled by investments, and even if it just sat there in government bonds, I think you'd have a nice tidy sum to pay out the recipients. I know that the Republican Party is very interested in getting Social Security money into the public, the private sector, such as the stock market and private investment firms. But I think that Social Security was never meant to be anything but a government entitlement program, and I think it works best that way. If we paid in our money and it was collected, and even if we only invested in government bonds, but the money was not pulled out for roads, it was not pulled out for other things, I think there would be a nice surplus. I will also say, I think our defense budget is about half of every dollar that we pay in our income tax. And that is certainly an excellent place to start trimming. In the Pentagon, they're not even doing audits because they go over so much, they find the audits embarrassing. And so I would definitely suggest that the money stay in Social Security, that it be invested wisely, and that we stop pulling out money to pay for other bills. I know that we have a huge deficit. This administration has created a huge deficit, and they think the Social Security entitlement program will help bail them out. I would hate to see that. I don't feel that most people want to be bothered with figuring out where they should put their money. I think it's much, for many, many years, and still until they started pulling out that Social Security money to pay for other bills, I think it was doing quite well. And I'd love to hear your guest's comment on that.
Well, you've certainly raised a number of points. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There were a number of interesting points raised there, and let me tackle three of them. The first is that it's important to recognize that pension systems like CSRS, which is the state university retirement system, as well as private pension plans, differ in a very important way from Social Security, in that these plans, whether they succeed or not, are actually designed to be what we call funded, so that when the money flows in, that money is supposed to go into investments and actually contribute to savings. Social Security system was not set up that way in the beginning. It was, in fact, set up as a system of income transfer. What this means is that the idea of just leaving the money to stay in Social Security and not spending it for other things, unfortunately, that would not solve the problem. Let's suppose that every penny that has been paid into Social Security system up till now had, in fact, been saved in some special savings account. That would be the equivalent of today's trust fund, which is a little over $1.4 trillion today. That is woefully insignificant compared to the implicit debt that the system faces. So The problem that Social Security faces today is not really a result of, you know, people spending the surpluses and so forth, although that's contributed on the margin a little bit. The problem is really this demographic issue that I mentioned earlier, that the program started out as this transfer system. We started out with very large numbers of workers supporting each retiree, and that ratio is falling. And we just can't continue to sustain that type of a system without tax rates going extremely high or without doing something to adjust benefits. The last point I wanted to make is one of the calls that is often made is, look, instead of doing individual accounts, let's have the government centrally invest that money. This has been done in some other countries around the world. And unfortunately, what it often leads to is a lot of sort of political interference in the investment process. So, for example, I read an article just yesterday in New Zealand, a big controversy there about which companies they're going to invest in and how much of the money should stay in New Zealand versus the international capital markets. You can imagine the difficulty in the United States if the government or a government body controlled a large fraction of the stock market, the debates that would ensue about you know, should we be suing Microsoft and investing in Microsoft at the same time, or should we be investing in cigarette manufacturers and so forth? And one of the benefits of personal accounts over centralized investment is that we no longer have the federal government playing that large of a role in the corporate governance structure in the United States.
We have other callers. Let's go next to another Urbana person. This is line number two. Hello.
Oh, yes. My understanding is that I might get the figures wrong, but anyway, is that Social Security tax, your tax for Social Security up until you make about, what, $68,000?
It's currently $87,000.
Oh, $87,000. I knew it was either $68,000 or $86,000, something like that. But anyway, so my question is, why don't people ever talk about, you know, just allowing the rich to pay their fair share of Social Security tax? I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that a Bill Gates will pay, you know, just the exactly same amount of Social Security tax as someone that makes $87,000. Take away that cap and voila, problem's fixed.
This actually is a proposal that some people have put forward, and the support for it actually doesn't always fall along the lines that one might expect. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt set up the Social Security system back in the 1930s, he felt very strongly that he wanted there to be as tight of a link as possible between the contributions that a person paid in and the benefits that they received, because he felt that the long-term political sustainability of the system would be best that way. If it looked like too much of a system where, you know, we were having the rich pay a lot and get very little, and there was a lot of redistribution, his concern was that political support for the program would unravel. It is true that people only pay in up to $87,000 today. It is also true, however, that their benefits are capped as though they only made $87,000. It's also true that the benefit formula is meant to be somewhat progressive so that they actually get a lower benefit per dollar paid in than people further down the income distribution. But having said all that, it's certainly one way of raising tax revenue, if that's the route we want to go, is to raise that cap, and then we would have to decide whether we also want to raise the benefits they pay or not.
Okay, and my main concern with private accounts is that I doubt if the government will say, okay, we now pay whatever percentage we pay now, and we're going to tack on an extra 5% tax on you to fund your private Social Security account. So I'm afraid that basically what's going to happen is you're going to have all the private accounts, you know, sucking money away from the general account, and then there won't be the safety net, which I would prefer Social Security to be a pure safety net than to have all these various and sundry stock market accounts and, you know, look at Enron and, well, anyway. But, you know, my main concern is that it will just, you know, it'll change Social Security from a safety net to yet another form of forced IRA, and then eventually people will be left with, you know, such a, you know, and then that will just increase the problems. They will keep on saying, yeah, now they get individual accounts, but we can't fund the safety net, so maybe we should just get rid of it altogether. And that's ultimately where the, you know, some of the, you know, business conservative-minded folks want to go.
I would say that, I mean, no one has the crystal ball to say for sure how these things will evolve in the future, but I can say that of the plan, the leading plans that I have seen that would introduce these personal accounts, most of them recognize the very important role that Social Security plays in providing that safety net. So, for example, some of the plans that the President's Commission put forward, to the extent that they were reducing the growth rate and benefits, they did so more for upper-income people than for lower-income individuals. It's also the case that in the President's Commission proposals from a couple of years ago, that they actually recognized that even the existing system was not doing a very good job of providing the safety net for the poorest among us, particularly elderly widows and so forth. And they actually put in additional protections for them. And I think ultimately for any type of a proposal to go through, we're going to need some sort of a mixed system like that. And I personally believe that while there are some who would like to see the whole system unravel, that the vast majority of even supporters of personal accounts would like to continue to see some basic benefit in place.
We are moving into our last 10 minutes here in this part of Focus. We're talking with Jeffrey Brown. He's assistant professor of finance at University of Illinois. We staked out a lot of territory in this morning's program. We've been talking primarily about Social Security. And if I'll tell you what happens, if we get to the end and we never do duck about pensions, we'll say, we'll come back. You can come back on another day, and on that day we'll just
and I'd be happy to
do the
that.
Pension part. All right.
Sure.
But we'll continue, though, to talk with people here on the phone, and the next caller is on the campus on line three. Hello.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out that the Social Security Administration for years has passed GAO audits as far as their accounting being up to snuff, whereas the Department of Defense has failed for years. And they can't, last I heard, they couldn't account for $1 trillion worth. So I think it'd be nice to, if we're going to tighten our belts anywhere, it'd be with the Department of Defense. Two, I'm with the people who say, just raise the cap. There's no reason why we shouldn't. Paul Simon, a couple years ago, I believe, suggested that if we just raised the cap and also corrected the COLA, provisions and Social Security, that we'd go a long way to allaying any fears in this area, because right now the increases because of cost of living are kind of inflated. And he pointed out that if the price of beef goes up, the COLA goes up, but what actually happens is a lot of people switch to chicken, and which is correct, you know. Number three, I guess one of the big things for me is, or rather, I'd like to know from you. You said earlier that even if the $1 trillion we have. If you made the virtual lockbox a real trust fund, and we had $1 trillion, it would be much less than the liability that we have in front of us. And I heard somebody say something like, between the I think it's 2015 and maybe 2040 something, the government is going to have to raise $20 trillion within a 15-year period, I think it was. Could you talk about what the numbers are that you're referring to there as far as what's in front of us, the liability? And are you talking about present values or what? Because that seems so far out of whack.
Okay, sure. There's a number of things there. Let me first say, with regard to your comment about the Social Security Administration passing their audits, the Social Security Administration is not and never has really been the problem here. They're actually a well-run organization. The issue, again, is the demographic change that's just causing us not to be able to continue on the benefit path that we're on. The other thing, as far as the cost of living adjustment, I mean, that is something that is being tossed around. This is basically a part of a broader debate about how accurately the Consumer Price Index actually reflects true cost of living in the United States. There's a lot of work that has been done to show that it is somewhat overstated. That is one way of reducing benefit payments, is to have a less generous cost of living adjustment. It helps. All of these things, however, or no one of these things can solve the whole problem, is the point. Because of the demographic changes that we're seeing and that are continuing and are continuing to worsen, the outlook of the system just looks worse and worse and worse the farther out on the horizon we go. And so while some of these changes make good short-term sense and can save some money in the short run, they're not enough. As far as the dollar figures, I'm happy to give you some numbers, although I find a lot of people, billions and trillions, boggle their mind. But for those that are interested, if we were to take the present value of all of the benefits that we're going to have to pay under the current system and subtract out the present value of all those taxes that we're planning to collect, that's sort of a measure of the shortfall. And it's on the order of $10 trillion, which is about the size of the U.S. economy in a given year, and is far greater than the sum of all the publicly held national debt in this country. So it's a very big number. And certainly $1 trillion in a virtual or a real trust fund would help, but it's a small part of the problem.
Again, I hope the caller will forgive me. We're getting short on time and have some others, and we'll go to Urbana and line number one for our next. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm not sure I trust this administration very much. I'm looking at this administration's corollary, Medicare circumstance for prescriptions. And they have specifically told Medicare in this bill, which I pray does not pass, that they cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies to bring down the prices. They're specifically told they may not negotiate. Well, it seems to me that opens the public coffers to whatever the pharmaceutical people want to charge, and that could bankrupt Medicare. And I do get the feeling that that is what this administration is interested in. They'd be happy to bankrupt Social Security. They would be happy to bankrupt Medicare, and they think that everybody ought to go the business route. Well, as Bush said in his very first presidential debate before he was elected, well, what do people think, that Social Security is an entitlement program? Well, as a matter of fact, it is. So when this administration talks about reforming Social Security, I think of how they want to give us pharmaceuticals in Medicare by just having the pharmaceutical companies raid the Medicare treasury. And so when they talk about doing things to Social Security, I see them very concerned with the private sector, but not at all concerned with people. Yeah. And I'd be happy to hear your reaction, sir.
All right. Again, you want to comment on that?
I guess all I'll say is two things. First, on the Medicare issue, every issue that faces Social Security basically faces Medicare as well. In addition to others, Medicare is in many ways an even larger problem. I mentioned with the previous caller that we faced a $10 trillion present value deficit for Social Security. The number's even larger for Medicare going forward. And I myself question to what extent we can actually solve a fiscal problem in Medicare by adding new expenditures to the program. But nonetheless, as far as the caller's concerns about the goals of the current administration, all I can say is that the individuals that I worked with in the White House on the Social Security issue are very committed to trying to do the right thing for the fiscal health of the country. And, you know, I just have to disagree with you on that point.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We have another caller I want to try to get in Indiana, Coal City, Indiana, line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hello. You know, you're right. Social Security is in a mess. It's going to keep on getting in a mess because all the manufacturing base in the United States is going out of the country. We're going to cheaper wages. Now the next step is going to India. President Bush wants to open up the markets in Africa, which all he's after is cheaper wages yet for these multinational companies. with the companies and the high-wage jobs moving out, you're losing, people's going down in wages, so that means they're taking in less money in Social Security. That means they're not going to get on Medicare. They're not have no medical. Then what happens is that you're going to have an outcry for nationalized health insurance, and we're just in a spiral down. Unless something is done about the manufacturing base in this country, we are in trouble. We cannot be a nation of shopkeepers. It just can't work. And, I think this president's got us in trouble, big trouble. Thank you.
Well, let's, okay, I appreciate, again, the comment. Is there some relationship between the difficulties the system is facing and the average wage that people are earning? And is there any truth to that, the argument that says, well, people are less well-employed, we've lost a lot of jobs that pay people a solid wage, and that people are earning less, and as a result, they're paying less into the system, and that's part of the problem.
Well, it is the part that I can certainly agree with is the fact that what happens to wages and productivity growth and so forth in this country, I mean, these are sort of key outcomes and determinants of economic growth, and there's no doubt that in a bigger economy with better paying jobs and so forth, we're in a position to better be able to support retirees in retirement. I want to make a couple of points, though. One is that any one of these changes, we can think of all the assumptions that go into these models measuring the future of Social Security, and we can think about the net change, sort of how quickly wages are growing on average. So we can think about unemployment. We can think about productivity. If we make all of those things far more favorable, the Social Security actuaries do these sensitivity analysis, and suppose we moved them all and sort of made them all the best case scenario. All that we really do in terms of the start of these deficits is postpone them by maybe 4 years. So it actually, even though growth can be a very powerful thing in the long run, but it doesn't change the fact that we need to change the structure of the system in order to be able to continue to afford it. The final thing I would note is that one of the reasons for this is that wage growth is certainly a wonderful thing, and we'd like to see more of it. Wage growth, however, also implies that benefits grow, at least under the current formula, and therefore not only would our tax revenue rise, but so would the cost of paying benefits. One of the things that the Social Security Commission of a few years ago recommended was cutting that link so that benefits in the future would grow with inflation rather than with wages, so that if we did see positive wage growth, that would actually help the health of the system, and that's a reform option that I think is one worth considering.
Well, we've come here to the end of our time and got through about half of the territory we thought we'd like to cover. So if you would, maybe in about a month, come back. We'll talk about the pension side of this.
I'd be more than happy to.
Take
I enjoy
other,
this.
Comments from people. But in the meantime, we'll say thanks to our guest, Jeffrey Brown. He's Assistant Professor of Finance at University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.